You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 415 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Whoa! It's the Lauren Jackson edition of the Pelton Cast?
You're just not even going to go with the Tax Day edition because it went so poorly.
The first time you did it, you didn't introduce me the last time. You just went straight into it.
No, you talked about something else.
You did the whole thing. You were like, we're coming to you from Renton, Washington.
When you talk, I assume you're going to say your name.
Do we have to do a third one?
I don't introduce you. You introduce yourself, friend. If you choose not to do it, that's up to you.
I like me saying I'm ready to go and then opening up the notes, not paying any attention. And now we're on time number three.
No, we're continuing with this one.
Okay.
But it's the Lauren Jackson episode of the podcast.
There we go.
Did you see the stats she dropped last week? She's playing in the NBL1, which is not the actual main women's basketball league in Australia. So the competition is a little lighter, but for the Albury Wodonga Bandits, the other day she dropped 43 points, 22 rebounds, and 2 blocks.
Okay, so you're kind of an expert on the what is it called?
NBL1
in Australia, right?
Yes, it's a regional league.
So the Bandits that Lauren Jackson plays for, who's their historical rival?
Was there some joke you're going for here?
No, just... You never like this bit. when there's an obscure thing and I ask you serious questions about it. It's the thing, unfortunately, Joe Rogan on news radio...
Would always ask questions that way.
He was like really, really good on the radio. And so Bill McNeil was trying to like trip him up on the radio. And he was like, and Joe, tell us about whatever. And then Joe would answer like really coherently about something that he didn't expect him to know about.
Oh, yes. If I had known who the Bandits' rival was.
Yeah, you'd be like, well, the Bandits' rival is like just going into it. I try to do this bit all the time, and it never works.
We are coming up on Lauren Jackson's 43rd birthday.
Really?
It's going to be Saturday.
Wow. What better way to celebrate a 43rd birthday than announcing your return to the WNBA?
She's going to have to do it quick. Actually, I believe...
Who is a player? Let me throw this out there. There was a thing that J.J. Watt was like, if they call, I'm going to answer, right?
Oh,
and J.J. Watt, yeah, I think he's only like 32 or something.
Yeah, he's been retired for a year.
Yeah, no, he's like annoyingly to me young. But I was thinking about this. As little respect as I want to give him, if there was a major league team today that was like, they put up the bat signal, they were like, we need you. Ichiro is signing that deal.
Oh, yeah,
and
no,
you
100%,
know it.
100%.
You know that if the Mariners were like, you know what? We need you, Ichiro. He'd be like, I'm on the plane.
So I've got some terrible news for you.
What?
The WNBA's new prioritization rules fully kicked in this season. And any player who is still playing professionally elsewhere is of May 1st ineligible to sign the entire season.
Wow.
So Lauren Jackson has, we can report it here first.
No.
Lauren Jackson will not be playing for the Storm this season.
The Pelton Cast can report.
It is exclusive.
We can't report that about Ichiro and the Mariners, though.
No, we cannot credit. The exclusive must credit Pelton Cast. If you say Lauren Jackson is not going to play for the Storm this season.
I would love for that to be credited seriously.
The Pelton Cast rarely gets aggregated, which is definitely for the best.
I'm trying to think of who else. Who else would just be like, I'm there?
Who else is in the Ichiro class?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's definitely, like, Marshawn Lynch.
I don't think so at this point. I think Marshawn's good. He's got his acting career.
I don't know. He did come back, though, one more time. One more time than he probably needed to.
I mean, I agree. But that was to come back for Pete Carroll and the Seahawks.
It is true.
That situation doesn't exist. The only teams he's played for are the Seahawks and his hometown team, which subsequently moved to another city.
Well, he also played for the Bills.
No, but I mean, since he retired.
Okay.
Like, I'm saying...
Your teams he's played for...
But he didn't choose to go to the Bills. The Bills drafted him.
I understand.
The Bills landed on him. he chose to come back to play for the Raiders in Oakland and Pete Carroll. Those are the teams he's chosen to play for. End of list.
Okay.
Unless he played for the Raiders in Las Vegas also, but I don't think that timing works out.
I don't think so either. Right, people don't talk about that enough, about what we've lost at Seahawks, though, is that anytime Pete Carroll could pull up the Rolodex, and if you wanted a player who probably should have retired or was retired, they would come and play for Pete Carroll. Mike McDonald doesn't have that sway.
I mean, maybe he does with former members of the Baltimore Ravens defense.
He just didn't coach there long enough to even have those
relationships. But he was there as like a position coach before he was the defensive coordinator. Who's to say Terrell Suggs isn't unretiring?
T-Sizzle.
Come play for the Seahawks.
He has his acting career on Ballers on HBO.
I've got some bad news for you about Ballers.
You also
HBO.
Can't report on this podcast that Ballers isn't coming back.
No, I guess I can't do that.
HBO Max.
Doesn't seem to be the direction they're going. Well, we got a short list of toasts this week, but we do want to wish a farewell to Eric Johnson, who last week announced he's retiring in June after 31 years at Como, 39 years total as a broadcaster. Will most be remembered, of course, for his Eric's Little Heroes segment, developed when he was a sportscaster before moving over and becoming a news anchor. A transition you don't always see, I feel like.
No. So, I mean, you have Steve Rabel going from football player to anchor. Not sportscaster, just straight up anchor.
And, you know, I don't know if we're going to do a power ranking here between Dan Rather and Gene Enerson and Kathy Gertzen, but like also one of the all-time, he's on somewhere on there.
Raves?
On the Mount Rushmore of Seattle anchors in our lifetime.
Wait, say those names again. Gene Enerson, Kathy Gertzen.
Did I say Dan Rather?
I was like, I feel like Dan Rather's got this one.
Dan Lewis.
Maybe there's some question marks. You know, Dan Lewis was a legend.
Those were the four when we were kids.
So funny because at the time, Steve Rabel seemed like young. Dan Lewis was at King, though, right?
No.
He was at Como?
Yeah.
Wow.
He and Kathy Gertzen were together.
How strange. I feel like we never really watched Como that much. I felt like we were a King household.
I think so. But we also were all over the map a little bit, I would say. Depended on, I mean, because Steve Poole certainly was a formative presence.
It's the Evening Magazine lead-in. And then also you have must-see TV. I was listening to Chuck Klosterman's book about the 90s. And how much of TV watching was just, it's on.
I mean, I think, you know what I would read? I would read an essay on the shows that were in between Seinfeld and Friends.
That's, I mean, he talked a lot about it.
Did he? It's been a while since I read the 90s.
There was some show that he mentioned. Oh my God, who was on it?
So you've got The Single Guy.
That he mentioned that one. The Naked Truth starring Taya Leone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What was the one about?
There's so many. There's way, way too many to even name.
Oh, obviously.
Caroline in the City.
That's the one I was thinking of. Caroline in the City. Yes. Leah Thompson.
But there was some show that he mentioned that aired for two seasons and it had somebody who it had Patricia Heaton in it. And it was like millions of people watched the show. And the point was that nobody would ever talk about this. It's like it was prestige TV. And it was just in our lives. And like 20% of American households watched it. But like literally he said
that. But
now
if you dropped that show into 2024, it would be double the biggest show on TV.
It didn't even ring a bell that this was a show. And he was like, Patricia Heaton. I was like, oh, the person from Everybody Loves Raymond. What was it? Room for Two. Have you ever heard of that show?
It's not striking a chord.
Common? Oh, yeah. Boston Common is a good one. Two seasons on ABC in 1992 and 1993. And I'm sure if you looked at the ratings, viewers, 27.1 million watched the pilot. Like, the viewers did go down, but it was still, like, millions of people watched this show. And it wasn't, like, you know, you hear something and you're like, oh, yeah, I kind of remember that. I never heard this name in my entire life.
Yeah. Maybe we were watching ABC at that point.
The 90s were great, to be honest. That's every segment. I'm just like, wow, the 90s were awesome.
That's your conclusion?
Everything. Of course it's my conclusion. I grew up in the 90s.
Well, true. I recently reread something of Chuck Klosterman's where he was mentioning that the primary interest of people is comedic nostalgia for the recent past. So
yeah.
The 90s has faded from the recent past.
Is that in Killing Yourself to Live?
No, I think it's in Chuck Klosterman 4.
Oh, Chuck Klosterman IV.
Yeah, the anthology.
The 90s, it was just like, I'm like 4 years late to this book or whatever. He was cooking. That is where Chuck Klosterman really cooks.
You're only 2 years late, right?
It came out 2 years ago.
Because I distinctly remember that, I think this was the 90s tour, that Chuck Klosterman's book event was like the first thing I went to in person after the Omicron wave.
Oh, post-COVID? Okay. He talks about COVID a little bit in the book, but I feel like it's sort of like an addendum.
Yeah, he probably had written the most of it already or something like that. So
anyway, remember COVID?
hey, remember the 2020s when that appears on VH1? The COVID.
We had a global pandemic. It's like people talking about it. Global pandemics were really crazy at that time.
Who's going to be the talking head?
Joel McHale.
Quite possibly.
Forever and always.
Speaking of the 90s in Seattle. And
I did have that thought like a month ago there, where I was just like, I feel like it was the first moment that I had where we were truly in like basically a post-COVID world. It did not even register to me as a thing anymore. It was about a month ago where it was like, it is gone, kind of gone from my mind on like a daily basis.
I found it interesting. The NBA did not have a single player in COVID protocol all year. Actually the wild thing about it was going back and realizing how many had missed games because of it in 2002-23, which, you know, it doesn't feel like that long ago, but in those terms, it actually was.
This was definitely the first post-COVID sports season, like completely.
Yeah, it just was not.
It was gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So hopefully it continues that way. All right, should we continue our search for Seattle's best cookie?
Absolutely, we should.
This week, it took us to Cafe Hitchcock in kind of the edge of downtown in Pioneer Square in the historic Exchange Building. So the Hitchcock restaurant, which was kind of originated, now there's the Hitchcock Restaurant Group, although the actual Hitchcock restaurant doesn't exist, opened in Bainbridge Island in 2010, and Cafe Hitchcock in Bainbridge developed is a kind of a sister restaurant out of there. The Seattle location opened in 2017, a couple years after Hitchcock Deli in Georgetown began serving what once sparked our original attempted search for Seattle's best cookie. And then Hitchcock Deli closed in 2019 after I placed an order there for us to discuss it as part of our search for Seattle's
you
best
placed
sandwich.
An order and then they just didn't even have it, right?
they
was just
not
gone.
Exist.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I remember that.
They still had the online ordering set up, but they were not there to take it.
Suffice it to say, they probably were not Seattle's best cookie in that moment.
They were just not even Seattle's cookie. So the interesting thing about this is, the classic Hitchcock Deli cookie that we loved so was particularly notable because it not only had sea salt on the top, but also cocoa nibs.
Okay.
Which I have not seen on any other cookie before or since.
Cocoa nibs?
Yeah. You don't remember that?
I mean,
it was like little shaped.
I remember the existence of cocoa nibs.
On that, you don't remember them on that particular cookie?
Not really.
I mean, this
sounds great, to be honest.
This was a cookie that for a period of time, I probably ate more than any other cookie in Seattle because I'd go to. Why is that funny?
It's just such a hilarious distinction. I ate that cookie more than almost any other cookie in Seattle, as if anybody could define what cookie they've eaten the most in a city.
Who can't define that? I mean, I guess it's weird to say in Seattle. As
every
if I was eating...
other person can't define it.
I disagree with that, so let us know in the Discord if you can identify the cookie you've eaten the most. In Seattle is strange because it makes it sound like I was going to Portland and just housing.
I can't even tell which cookie is the one I've had the most. I mean, so many cookies down there.
Look,
I'll tell you, this is a hilarious way to describe something.
I don't think it is.
And that was the cookie that I ate the most, kids.
You don't know what cookie you eat the most often in your
Honestly,
life?
Honestly, no.
The answer is Hello Robin.
I mean, probably. It was probably Hello Robin because, I mean, homemade cookies is probably the cookies that I eat
well,
the most.
Well, yeah, sure.
But if we were tailgating, if I had any reason to be near the University of Washington or UVille, which I'm probably going to Hello Robin.
So I would often go and get a sandwich for lunch from Hitchcock Deli, which was the kind of their specialty, and obviously would get a cookie as well and heat it up a little bit in the microwave. And it was, again, for a period of time, what I considered Seattle's best cookie.
So I think this conversation started, this is our first ever search.
Yes.
It started because you were talking about this Hitchcock cookie.
Correct.
And you were like, it's the best cookie in Seattle. And I had to challenge that notion.
You did.
But fairly, and to everyone's delight.
I mean, not really, as we did not complete that search.
It was like an ongoing search. It wasn't, we hadn't quite formalized searches yet.
No.
In the way that we really understand them now. We don't make complicated brackets at all.
Seattle's best at donut. And Seattle's yeah. best donuts.
Live in September 2024. No, maybe.
Probably August.
August, okay. But just anytime somebody tells me that they've had the best X item, especially cookie, I want to try it. Second off, I'm just going to be like, I don't know about that.
Your instinct is to contrarianism.
Or just skepticism. I think that's fair.
Yeah. We're regressing the opinion to the mean.
But I think we might have settled on it was maybe the winner.
I don't know that we ever settled on anything, but it wasn't unseated for me until Bell's came along and then subsequently Treat, is what I would tell you.
Hello Robin wasn't.
It wasn't at that point. I think I have reevaluated Hello Robin since.
Okay. Wow.
We talked about it when we did that as part of the search.
Okay. So what is the difference between that cookie that you loved, and we have to remove your nostalgia for the cookie from this equation, to the cookie that we're eating now? Or is it almost like the nostalgia makes it worse because it can never live up to what you remember it tasting like?
Well, obviously it makes it worse. Okay. It makes it way worse.
Wow, so sorry, Hitchcock.
Even aside from the fact that there was no sea salt and no cocoa nibs on this.
It needs the sea salt, I'll be honest.
The composition was a little different. The density of chocolate was very different because I think there were kind of smaller chocolate chips sprinkled throughout the Hitchcock Deli cookie, whereas the Cafe Hitchcock is chocolate chunks.
Hey, I don't know if I like the chocolate chunks.
It reminded me in that regard is more similar to the Little J cookies that we had as part of this search, where you lamented like having a bite that was entirely a chocolate chunk.
That was exactly what I thought.
So I don't know if you, did you sense that similarity as well?
It was not quite as soft and gooey as you'd like it to be.
So that's the other thing is, I think we're just developing a few spectrums on which to analyze cookies.
Yes, absolutely.
And one of them is undoubtedly the crunchy, chewy spectrum.
Yeah.
And this is going hard on the crunchy side of the spectrum.
I don't know if I would say it's going hard because it was still, like, honestly, this is a very good cookie.
It's a good cookie.
You're describing it a little bit too negatively because I had it and I was like, all right, Cafe Hitchcock cookie. To me, I was like, it's a fringe bracket cookie. It is probably not Seattle's best cookie. It desperately needs sea salt, though. That is one thing where, to me, just if sea salt exists, put it on your chocolate chip cookies, people, right?
Do you put it on your homemade chocolate chip cookies?
Sometimes I do. For myself, I would every time. But I'm also a psycho when it comes to salt. Like, I would put on everything. I had an idea. Did I tell you about this? My ice cream place?
And no.
It's the snow on top ice cream. And so, like, every time I have ice cream, if it's, like, ice cream, a little bit of fudge, and then you put the snow on top, which is the salt, I will have salted everything, anything and everything, because the salt just brings out all of the other flavors.
I mean, that is what salt does.
I was imagining having this ice cream place and kids coming in and being soup Nazi status about having to have the salt on top, where it's like, that's the point here, people. You don't get to have the ice cream on its own without the snow on top.
If you don't want the snow on top, go over to Menchie's.
Yeah. You punk-ass kids. It's like, it was strictly like ice cream for adults. Because children, despite the maybe their taste buds don't need to be activated in the same way that adult taste buds need to be activated. Or maybe they're just dumb. One way or another.
Don't preview Coach's Corner.
They do not get the intricacies of how important it is to add salt plus another flavor.
They probably don't.
So we're settling on just dumb.
I think the other thing about this is, like, if you're going to be in contention for Seattle's best cookies and you only serve one cookie, Like, that cookie has to be better than any of the cookies at Hello Robin,
yeah,
or at Bell's or Chicorina or Batch or these other places that we know are, or Treat. I don't know why I haven't mentioned them as part of this conversation. Like, I don't think this cookie achieves that level. I think it was plausible that the Hitchcock Deli did. I think it's plausible the cookie at Met Market does. I don't think it's plausible with this.
Okay. All right. We shouldn't even have it in the bracket then. I'm not saying, but again, this is if I was at Cafe Hitchcock or near Cafe Hitchcock, yeah, I still would eat this cookie.
Yeah. I'm going to award this a Pelton Cast P for It's Worth a Detour.
Okay.
Or I don't know. It's Worth a Stop.
Clearly figured out searches.
Oh, yeah.
There's now Pelton Cast P's that are being awarded. That neither of us have any sense. I'm like, sure.
I have a sense of it.
Throw them out there.
Well, the Pelton Cast P is like, yeah, this is a cookie worth eating.
They cost nothing.
You
sure
deemed Costco no Pelton Cast P's.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely not. No, no peas. So. It's not worth eating. Get a hot dog, people. It's $1.50 and it comes with a soda. Are you kidding me?
Keep it at $1.50. The Costco podcast. Anything else on this?
On this, how long we've talked about this single cookie? No, I think I'm good.
All right, let's do Coach's Corner.
I forgot that we had Coach's Corner this week. So I took a week off from coaching the football team. And I really do, not for any purpose, just I wasn't sure whether I was allowed on the field. And
you were just in the stands?
I was just in the stands watching, like a normal person. And the hard thing is,
like a noob.
At Ren Memorial Stadium, they play, there's like three or four games happening on the football field at Ren Memorial Stadium. And according to the like league or whatever, we're in the Lombardi League, they named for Vince.
Thanks. Very helpful.
Just so you know, to clarify, not Mike. So everybody's in the stands, and they're like, we've only rented
not David Lombardi.
One side of the stands, not the other one. And so if your game's on one of the far fields away from where the stands are, you can't really see what's going on at all. There's no scoreboard. You have to be pretty fucking good at keeping score of what's going on or knowing what is awarded a touchdown or whatever, because really you have no idea, which is both a positive and a negative. And I was wondering, like during the children's basketball games that I coached, it gets tense in there, right? But at the Highlands Neighborhood Center, you are crammed in there. Every single parent knows what's going on. Even though they don't keep score, every single parent is like front and center, can see every bit of what's happening. At the football games, the parents are like hundreds of feet away. So like you can hear some cheering when a touchdown is scored, but you can't really get the like back and forth chatter. So it's both a positive because parents are annoying, myself included. Parents are annoying, but also because, well, it's a negative because you don't get the atmosphere in the same way.
Right.
It's really just like they're playing the game. Sunday, Seattle, Washington, beautiful day. It is probably like up there with one of the darkest, coldest, rainiest days in Seattle history.
On the shores of Lake Washington.
And it was like woke up, it was pouring rain. You have an hour-long practice beforehand. All of the children are complaining. They're asking to go to the bathroom. The coach is like, all right, everybody take a bathroom break. And then like 30 seconds later, all the kids are like, we have to go to the bathroom. And I'm just like, these kids do not want to be playing football right now. It's fine. I'm like, you're running around. I'm just standing here. Think about how I feel. So it's wet. It's gross. Team, however, is 2-0 heading into this game. And we're not about to lose, right?
I mean, that's not how you do it at the Lombardi League.
Yeah, in the Lombardi League.
Winning isn't everything. It's the only thing.
So what we have worked on, I think I told you we had run right, run left, pass, basically slants play, and then the reverse play.
Correct.
Which there's a pet peeve of mine that on a reverse, people call it a quote-unquote double reverse. You know,
correct,
about me complaining about this. It's just a reverse, people. And the other coaches, so we ran this play, and the other coaches were like, it's a double reverse. And I'm like, no, it's just a reverse. It was an end around before then, motherfucker. Anyway, we are cooking, right, with that. And then at some point, you're just like, we just can't. Like, you're going to score a touchdown on every single play. So the team is up like 28-6 or something. Mateo comes on for a two-point conversion. perfect pass, the only completed pass of the game to the end zone, like literally like 15 yards for a pass for a 7-year-old. So that was pretty impressive. He had a 2-point conversion completion. But then coming back, there's a pass thrown to him because we're literally just passing the ball because it's more fun. And also because we were up 28-6 and it was just like,
It's the opposite of real football where you take a big lead and you stop passing.
Yeah, no, it's just like we could score a touchdown on every single play if we wanted to, but that's not fun. What is more fun is completing passes with 7-year-olds. So the ball gets thrown up to Mateo. He like sort of drops it in the air and a defender comes up and tackles him and he is screaming at the referees.
Oh, no.
He was like, that's a flag. He tackled me going nuts on the field. He's like, I'm so wet and I'm so cold and that's a flag. I'm like, please do not get ejected from this children's football game. Fortunately, the referees wanted to be there as little as anybody wanted to be there. I was asking the kid, like, there's like a referee and then like a side judge. And I was asking him, like, I'm like, how much time is left? Like, do we have timeouts or whatever? And he's just like, I don't know. And I'm like, you know what, dude? I appreciate the energy that you have here. And the other team kept complaining about flag guarding, which I'm like, they're 7. That's where their hands are going to go. Like, you can't complain. They were complaining about calls constantly. And I'm like, my dude, we are all cold. We are all wet. Let's just go the fuck home. We do not need to complain to the referees in this 7-year-old football game that only we are, I guess, actually the referees do keep score in this one, in these games. But we started a game changer where we're now keeping score so that the parents on the sideline can actually follow along with what's happening.
Is this a secret game changer?
No, like, this is basketball? Like everybody knows about it.
Okay.
Kayleen was on the sideline and people over there, it's like, you know, the parents and grandparents, and they're like, what's the score? And she's like, it's in the game changer. And then they're like, but what's the score? So we have a doubleheader, a football doubleheader, the rarely seen football doubleheader coming up this Sunday.
On Mother's Day.
Yeah. For the moms out there. Oh, wow. Who want to spend their Mother's Day watching 7-year-olds play football.
Well, at least it won't be in the rain.
Not once, but twice. No, I honestly, like, I thought it was, I think the weather's not quite as nice as it was supposed to be on Sunday anymore, but.
The forecast has been downgraded?
Yeah, it's not like it's 80 degrees or something.
Okay.
I was like, I'd play 10 7-year-old football games if it's 80 degrees out. But on the shores of Lake Washington. But at least Mateo had his 2-point conversion completion, so that was 2 fantasy points for him.
Yeah. I know how much you love a 2-point conversion when one of your fantasy players scores it.
Honestly, sometimes even better than the touchdown.
It's because it's more thrilling and unexpected.
Yep.
All right, did you compose?
Oh, can I make one more complaint? Sorry, about flag football. So you start at the 40. The field goes one direction. Everybody comes back to where it started. It doesn't. There's not end zones on each side.
It's like they're playing a football game in the Giants baseball stadium in San Francisco when they used to do that.
They used to only go one direction there?
I think so.
Really?
That's how I recall it. Yeah.
There's no way that you could do that.
You flip the field whenever there's a change of possession.
Okay, so hear me out on this. Start at the 40. If there's a turnover on downs, that's where the other team starts.
Okay.
Think about what that means.
It means that it's...
If you drive 39 yards and get to the 1-yard line but don't score a touchdown, the other team gets the ball at the 1-yard line. If you drive 0 yards and give them the ball at the 40-yard line, the other team starts at the 40-yard line. So there is a scenario that it is better, like if it's 4th down, you would be better off taking a massive sack than trying to get the 1st down. Because what they should do is subtract the amount of yards that you've gained from the 40. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess so.
But they do the exact opposite. So you would then be punished by getting to the 1-yard line because the other team literally ends up with the ball on the 1-yard line.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
I mean, I have to emphasize, none of this matters. But
I'm
at the same time, just process-wise, it is really hard for me. Like, if you had a 4th down that you knew you weren't going to get, I'd be like, go take a massive sack, kid.
Sounds like amazing coaching.
Well, can you, the amount of game planning that would have to happen for that to happen and explaining to the kids. Like, there was a play, the very last play of the game. Mateo was the running back, but was instructed to pass the ball. Because you can't run as the quarterback, but if there's a handoff to you, you can either pass or run. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so what he did was he was handed the ball off, and it was basically a Hail Mary, so it was like 25 yards or something. If he would have run, he's probably scoring a touchdown, but the coach told him to pass it, so he didn't. I don't think the children process that rule, that if it's a handoff, then you can run. Like, that's the next level of football that we need to get to with them. But I think that we are going to really exploit that next week if we need to.
Okay, it turns out it was not the case at what is now Oracle Park.
Candlestick?
No, the new stadium.
Oh, okay.
But it did happen when Illinois and Northwestern played at Wrigley Field. They only used one end zone entire game. So
you said that as if you were thinking of that.
I mean, I knew it had happened at some point
at a baseball
in a college
stadium.
Football game. That was, yeah. Or did you do takes?
No. I think we should take a week off from takes.
A take off? We're just going to talk about the Mariners?
I think we should just talk about the Mariners normally.
Well, they've won six consecutive series now, having come from behind to win Sunday in Houston and take two of three from the Astros in a series that if they had lost two of three, would have done so in like excruciatingly frustrating fashion, which I feel like is exclusively how the Mariners lose, I would say. I mean, maybe this is just baseball.
I didn't get to see any of the game on Sunday that they came back and won. And it's so funny when you just look at the box score and you're like, all right, the Mariners won.
Yeah, it looked like a completely reasonable game.
And yeah, 5-4, nice victory.
The emotional swings of scoring two runs early, knocking out the Astros starter, and like Logan Gilbert's going, like, there's no way they can come back now. And then the 4-3 lead, and then the Mariners coming back.
This was Bryce Miller.
Oh, sorry, Bryce Miller.
Bryce Miller's on Sunday. Gilbert was the one who freaking shut them down.
Gilbert was Saturday.
Yeah.
But Miller was dealing as well. Like, he was cruising through the first five innings or whatever it was until all of a sudden he wasn't. And then the Cal home run in the top of the ninth off of Hader, who is a month into a five-year contract, and it's not going great thus far.
I mean, that is not one that I've ever argued for. I was going to say
Cy Young
odds through this part of the season that Gilbert would be in the mix. And I'm going to still say that. I mean, he's fourth in the AL in ERA, 169. His whip is .79, which is better than anybody. I didn't realize how good Jose Berrios has been pitching.
Are we sure there are not odds for this? Should I go look this up?
Absolutely, you should. Okay. I mean, right now, it's Jose Berrios, Cutter Crawford, Seth Lugo, Logan Gilbert, Ronel Blanco, who pitched very well against the Mariners, right?
I don't know. I don't know on that one. Player Futures 2024. We've got, okay, MVP, Cy Young. Logan is plus 1,000, which are the third best odds behind Tariq Skubal and Corbin Burns. Castillo is plus 1,800. Miller and Kirby are both plus 2,200.
Bryce Miller is not winning Cy Young.
I mean, that would be really, like, if Bryce Miller wins the Cy Young, that would be a pretty amazing outcome for the Mariners. But they have four of the top one, two, three, top nine in AL Cy Young odds.
Ronel Blanco beat the Mariners, but did not pitch that well.
Okay.
On Friday.
Yeah, I mean, he benefited. That was a game that they should have very much have won, and then things got weird in the late stages of that one. So,
just a frustrating loss, I'll be honest. But, I mean, they went ahead on a bunt.
Yeah.
It was so horrible to watch. But still taking two of three from the Astros, it's one of those things where, despite the fact that the Astros are 12-20 or whatever, were 12-20. It's still important to beat the Astros in a series like that.
It's hugely important to
beat
the
very
Astros.
Very scary 12-20.
They came into that series still number two in odds to win the AL West on FanGraphs. They have now
why does FanGraph hate the Rangers?
I mean, their projection entering the season was very poor.
What is it? So it's all preseason projections?
Yeah.
Because FanGraphs likes the Mariners a little bit too much.
I don't know if I'd say that necessarily. They like the Rangers too little. They've got them as a 500 team the rest of the season, 507. The Astros winning 55% of their games the remainder of the way, and the Mariners at 53% the remainder of the way. So I think that's reasonable for the Mariners. Like, that's less than the clip they're currently playing at.
It just doesn't like the Rangers.
Yes.
Okay.
Has not, does not, will not.
I think the Polanco emergence, some of the balls that they were hitting, this was on Saturday in that game against the Astros. The way that the Mariners were hitting the ball, and I mean, they ended up winning it comfortably. They didn't need all these runs, right? Which 5 runs to the Mariners is like, whoa!
Save some of these for tomorrow, guys.
But the amount of hard-hit balls that the Mariners had in that game was like, it was unlike seeing the team. And I thought Polanco in particular was hitting the ball very well. They weren't all hits, but just everybody on the team was hitting the ball hard. And that's something that you could imagine. I mean, we talked about this last week. The Mariners right now are offensively nowhere near their potential.
No.
And I think that's why if you had any, if you wanted to have room for hope beyond having the best pitching staff in baseball, this offense has so much further to go. J.P. Crawford's going to come back at some point. There really aren't that many day-to-day players outside of Josh Rojas, who is a day-to-day player, but sort of on the fringes.
I mean, he should play as much as possible at this point.
There's almost nobody else who I would say is exceeding their expectations at this point. Like, if you went in this, I guess Dylan Moore, 0.8 WAR, but he's not really hitting that well.
Yeah, it's largely the fact that he's playing shortstop.
But Julio is not at expectations hitting-wise right now. And mm-hmm. I don't buy that Julio's going to be at, 604 OPS and one homer. Things are going to change for Julio, and they're going to change fast. And if this pitching staff is in the same place by the time we get to June, July, I mean, the fact that we're already into May is like, okay, we're not at the very early stages of the season. But if the Mariners get to, we talked about this last week, if the Mariners get to July, to late June, and the offense is still looking the way it's looking, they have to be at, it's time to make a trade. Like, they can't, they just cannot. Seeing the trade that the Padres made for Arias was, I didn't see what the Padres gave up, but it was just like, was that there? Was that a thing that the Mariners could have done?
I'm sure it was a thing that they could have done, yeah. I mean, a lot of the appeal for the Padres was the Marlins' willingness to eat salary the rest of the way and give up better prospects because of this.
Would that not be a thing that would be appealing to the Mariners?
I'm sure it would be. I'm saying it's not a thing they should probably be giving up prospects for. Also, Arise, I think last season was probably something of a fluke. So, like, he's a nice player. He would certainly be helpful to the Mariners. But I also don't know that he's the guy.
But they don't have anybody. It's not that they need the guy. They need a guy. I mean, the guy is Julio, but they need Julio to be Julio at some point.
Yes. Yes, they do.
And that's why you end up losing games like this game to the Twins 3-1 earlier today. They're winning these series. They're not sweeping. They're doing exactly what they need to do. Just win every series. Now the pressure's on with this Twins game, the Twins series.
Yes,
when you lose game one,
have to take two in a row.
And with Castillo starting as well to lose, and Castillo pitched great, but to lose a Castillo start is, I don't. He's really lost a lot of them.
Yeah, is expected and really through no particular fault of his own. I mean, he didn't start the season well, but, you know, you just allow 2 runs in almost 7 innings. You should be okay.
I think only one of them was earned, too. I don't know if you care about that sort of thing.
I hear there was a horrendous defensive misplay by Ty France. I was not watching at that particular point. So,
but Logan Gilbert's your most important Mariner right now.
I would probably still go Josh Rojas, but
he's number 2 in WAR. Gilbert and Rojas. That's the timeline. Like, that is the timeline right there.
A bit of news off the field since we last recorded. The Mariners announced new minority investors with Microsoft Vice Chair Brad Smith and his wife, Kathy Saras Smith, joining the ownership group. Ken Griffey Jr. was the only other new partner since the local ownership purchased the Mariners in 1993. On Twitter, Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times downplayed the significance of the move, saying they had bought, quote, minimal shares. So for everyone who was hoping like, oh yay, new money in the ownership group, now they're going to start spending, like, no, probably that's not going to change anything.
I would advise against hope.
It's always the best strategy. Hope is a dangerous thing.
In fact, I'm not even, this is way too positive a take. I'm not even just going to advise against hope. I'm going to say, with the way that this roster is constructed right now, we don't need hope from the ownership group, because we've got Luis Castillo, Logan Gilbert, George Kirby, Bryce Miller, Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Rowley. There is a young core. They don't need that one player, right? They don't need like the influx of money to go do something differently. Things are built really nicely right now. And they need the kind of thing that prospects get you, not the kind of thing that money gets you.
I mean, money helps in that as well.
I understand, but like, I think people see that and they're like, now we're getting Soto or whatever. And I don't, which obviously would take, but like, I think it's more about building in different ways for this Mariners team. Not to regurgitate their talking points, but
yeah, that was,
they're just right. Are they not right now?
About building from within?
About how the team is currently built. They need better hitting right now, but like, I don't know. They're in a pretty freaking good place.
They keep demonstrating to us that free agency is bad.
With the players they sign?
Yes. They're going out of their way to prove it.
I think that maybe an underrated way of viewing how to acquire players. I think free agency is probably bad unless you're signing somebody like Shohei. Acquiring very good young players and being able to keep them and pay them,
yeah,
that's important.
Yeah.
And that's different than acquiring somebody to be a free agency.
I agree.
If you could go get Mookie Betts, trade for Mookie Betts, and then pay Mookie Betts to still be on your team, that's why it matters. And obviously they're able to sign Shohei, but like, Shohei is also pretty much, Shohei is a once-in-a-generation free agent.
But it is strange because, like, when the Mariners signed Julio, it's like a whole different thing from free agency, because a lot of what they're doing is just, Julio, you don't have any potential downside risk. You know, if suddenly you can't hit a curveball anymore, it doesn't matter. You're still going to make... I'm sorry. If suddenly you can't hit a fastball anymore, you don't have the downside risk if you're not going to make very much money in your career. You are set for life. But when, like, the Dodgers trade for Betts, he was a year away from free agency, right?
You have to be able to pay him.
But like,
you're seeing the downside risk of trading for him.
It is strange that those contracts seem to work out better than just signing a player in free agency, because the player knows what they're going to get in free agency. That's not a secret. Like, you're paying market rate to retain them. But I agree that for some reason those deals seem to work out better.
You're saying like Castillo coming back or Mookie Betts, or like if the Padres had just signed Soto?
Is compared to the guys who have actually changed teams via free agency have tended to not work out at all for their new teams.
I think there's a reality of when a player hits free agency, it's also a two-way street. A player has to be allowed to hit free agency.
I suppose so.
And if a team wanted a player back that much, they would not have allowed that player to hit free agency. And teams usually know the most about their own players.
It is definitely, there's an information asymmetry here.
So, I mean, there are obviously examples of good free agents, but, or a lot of times it's like, hey, we might be able to count on this player for 1 year. Mookie Betts is way younger, though.
That is the other element of it, yes, is usually when those guys are extended, it's at a younger age than the guys who hit free agency, because
they're like 32.
They tend to be players that developed quicker, got to free agency quicker, etc.
The whole system's just kind of broken in baseball. Like, it's not, this is not an anti-spending money take. It's more of the way that baseball is structured with arbitration years is that by the time you hit free agency, you're kind of out of your prime.
Yeah.
So that's just, it's a really complicated place. But this influx of cash, if it is a real thing.
There is no influx of cash.
If there were to be an influx of cash and you wanted to have hope, it would be spending in all of the other places. Spending in development in the minors, spending in international free agents.
Well, that's limited.
I mean, it's sort of limited. It's limited like by year. You could spend a certain amount, right?
But I don't think anyone isn't spending the amount you can spend without being
every
like,
team's basically
a draft
spending
pick.
the max.
I would assume so.
On international free agents.
Someone can correct me on that if I'm wrong. Which, but, by the way, as I put in the post notes, Sam Haggerty can be sent down. It's option years, so they've already burned the option year.
Best
but
donuts.
So he can continue to be set down as much as is needed the remainder of the season. Or not, I guess, as much as needed. There is a limit at some point, but...
So it's just this season he can go up and down a bunch. Yes. Well, I hope he doesn't.
It'd be nice at some point if Sam Haggerty got ahead. But...
Still waiting on elusive hit one.
Sam Haggerty looking for Sam Haggerty's best hit.
I feel like he gets on base pretty often. Maybe not this year.
That's pinch running.
To pinch run, somebody else would have to get on base.
I feel like he's been good defensively, but yes, when he's been on base, it's because he's pinch running.
Wait, looking at the player batting stats, Sam Haggerty does not appear. No. I mean, he's only had 8 at-bats.
Okay.
And 1 walk. Like, I don't know. That is way too little to judge him from.
It's totally fair. I just would like to see the not zero when he comes up to the plate.
Then not. I totally agree. It's so funny that all of my favorite Mariners are fringe speedy players. Like if you were like who are the players who've been most excited this year? You're like, well, Clase for sure, of course. Leo Rivas definitely. Haggerty and then Samad Taylor. I'm like, just
I've
give
not
me,
seen a lot of Leo Rivas.
Give me the whole roster built out of those guys.
But he's bringing great vibes to the dugout.
Great vibes. Honestly, things haven't really been the same since Clase went down. Or maybe they have. I don't know. I guess.
I think they, in fact, have.
They have been the same.
I haven't looked. We're not doing. Well, I mean, they have not been as good, I don't think.
And but. I'm weirdly prejudiced against Dylan Moore. He's like aged out of this territory.
He's
if Dylan Moore is
a very
Moore's
solid shortstop.
Like too good to be in this territory. Right. And so he gets to the point of annoying because you see enough of him and you're like, yeah, I'm good on Dylan Moore, right? Like he's played in 26 games. Sam Haggerty's only had a handful of at bats. You know, if Haggerty had been playing in as many games as Dylan Moore, he'd be doing way better.
All right, should we get into the roundup?
Everybody's favorite.
Ron Francis responded to the Seattle Times on the report by my ESPN colleague Emily Kaplan that a significant crack in players made it clear they did not want to play for the team if Dave Haxtell remained the head coach. Francis said, zero players issued any ultimatums of any kind regarding the coach. That I can assure you, that's not what those meetings are really about. No one sits there asking them, what did you think of the coach? And there I find, Ron Francis, you doth protest too much.
Oh, hello. I was going to dispute this too, but you came in with the disputation.
Because yes, I agree. The general manager would never say, what did you think of the coach? Because you wouldn't want to put the player in position to say that. But would a disgruntled player bring it up of their own volition during an exit interview?
Absolutely.
Fuck yes.
Honestly, like if you would have asked me last week, if you would have been like, hey, what do you think Kraken, Ron Francis, the general manager or whatever?
Yes.
What do you think that the Kraken general manager is going to respond to this? He's definitely not going to confirm it.
No, I mean, it falls under the... What do you expect him to say?
Exactly. Category. I could have told you that this was what this quote was going to be beforehand.
Winger Jordan Eberle also told KJR, by no means did anyone go in with an ultimatum. That's just not how our team operates. Which again, like, you weren't in the room. You might think that's not how your team operates. Other people might feel differently.
Yeah, sorry, Jordan.
So
that is how our team operates, and it's how every team operates.
I mean, I don't know if it's how every team operates.
Ultimatum, that's the thing. Like, a lot of it is being placed on the word ultimatum.
Which is not used in the original report. You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
That's not for me, for once, right?
Yeah, it is.
Just being clear here.
I mean, maybe it was in the report and I missed it, but I don't remember it.
I thought it was. But it's
all
just
right,
like, there's a difference between a quote-unquote ultimatum and high level of disgruntledness.
Yes.
It's whatever. They can't give that much power to the players because they have to go out there and hire another coach, A. And so if a coach is looking at it, at the situation and being like, well, I'm not going to go there where all they do is listen to these fuck-ass players. But like, there's a reality they would just never do that as an organization. And you never throw the players under the bus.
Yeah, I'm not seeing the term ultimatum in the quote of Emily Kaplan.
That's how you know that there was an ultimatum, is they brought it up.
Exactly. Like, it's like when you ask a question and you don't mention the thing, and the other person brings up the thing, and you're like, aha!
Yeah. Yeah, Jordan Everly. I mean, I like the ultimatum gate for the Kraken. It's like, literally, didn't care about the Kraken for a few months, but I care about this.
This is the most interesting thing the Kraken have done since the outdoor game.
Maybe it should make the whole team out of ultimatums. So funny. This is the most that I've enjoyed talking about the Kraken in months.
If we can turn it into semantics, then I'm here.
I'm telling you, the transact is what it's all about.
Oh, yes. Well, speaking of teams playing thrilling games and not transacting, Seattle Sounders.
Whenever I get the ESPN notification with the Sounders, I'm just like,
yet another scoreless draw on Sunday against the LA Galaxy.
I feel bad for the people who had to be in attendance.
I mean, I watched this one. It wasn't an unexciting match necessarily. Like, they had some chances. They got the better of opportunities. 1.4 XG to 0.5 for the Galaxy.
That doesn't change what I said. We really had some solid possession there before. Nothing happening.
Oh, no. It was only their second nil-nil draw of the season. Oh, great.
Out of 11 matches, that's almost 10% of the games that a thing didn't happen.
Wait, what percent do you think it was?
You said, it's happened two times and they played 11 games?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's almost 20% of the time that a thing hasn't happened.
It is the fifth time this season they have failed to score. They have 4 clean sheets to their credit. Sounders open U.S. Open Cup play on Wednesday.
They better start issuing some ultimatums to get people to pay attention to this team.
USL Championship side, Louisville City FC. And then on Sunday.
Wait, Louisville City's not in the MLS?
They're not in MLS.
Are they sure?
I mean, I'd have to double check the standings. They have a fierce rivalry with St. Louis City. Which, by the way, brother Noah Cohen came through on the Discord with the receipts on St. Louis's soccer.
I feel like
town
it might have been highly Italian. Now all of a sudden I'm for it.
Yes. That it was the 1950 World Cup, first off, where the U.S. defeated England.
There we go.
And it was a team that featured multiple players from the Italian neighborhood in St. Louis.
There we go.
So.
We're back. St. Louis back in good graces.
It turns out they were not that good at winning the U.S. Open Cup, speaking of the U.S. Open Cup, but still a very strong soccer tradition in
Louisville
St. Louis.
Louisville City FC sure sounds like an MLS team to me.
I agree, it does. I mean, I don't know what the expansion process is. They could be coming.
It is one of those teams where, you know, like, they've set it up where they're just like on the path.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
They're on the track. Wasn't Sacramento like that? Cincinnati?
Yeah, I don't know
if
they ran out of money.
It's easy.
Well, if you make
why the teams are bland, though. We talked about this last week. It's because they're just like, well, this looks like an MLS team. We might as well just throw them in there. We could have endless MLS teams.
That's necessarily the reason why. Will Louisville get an MLS team? No current plans are in place for Louisville. Okay, the club has stated they have no plans or intentions of joining the MLS.
Really?
Wow.
And that's not like a Ron Francis no intentions. We're believing that one.
I mean,
everybody has a plan and an intention to join the MLS.
I suppose so.
That's actually one of my most base perspectives, is that no matter what, this actually is kind of like a Chuck Klosterman thing, but I've felt this irrelevant of him. No matter what a person says, basically every single person has the exact same goals. There was some band that a coworker was like, does this band want to be famous or whatever? And I'm like, every band wants to be famous. There's never a band that's like, oh yeah, nobody coming to our shows. Let's fucking go.
But you could want to be a certain level of
when
famous.
When you have gotten to the point, no, every band secretly wants to be the most famous.
Do you think that I want to be the most famous sports writer?
Secretly?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
No.
No, I don't know if that's
exactly
the goal of a sports writer necessarily, but you do work for ESPN. You're not like, let's just be clear here. You work for the biggest company.
It is true.
When you name your team.
We're getting our reports refuted by Ron Francis and Jordan Everly. That's how important.
When you name your team Louisville City FC and you're in a city without an MLS team and your team sounds like an MLS team, all of a sudden you might find yourself wanting to be an MLS team.
Okay.
So anyway, that's my theory is every single person has the exact same goals.
Well, on Sunday.
Despite what their stated goals may be.
The Sounders goal will be to score some goals against the Portland Timbers in their first match.
I think the Sounders
season.
Might be the only team whose goal is not.
No. No, it's still their goal. They're just not very good at it. First matchup this season against Portland, the teams come in tied for 11th in the West with identical 2-5-4 records.
Oh,
but
Lord.
They have gotten there in wildly different ways. Portland's 20 goals rank third in MLS, and their 23 goals allowed are second most.
Hello.
The Sounders have 13 of each. So Portland coming close to doubling them up in
it
terms
is like
of total
sometimes
goals.
I look at the MLB standings and I see some of the other teams who've scored so many runs and I'm like, wow, that team must be really good. And then they've given up a lot of runs. And I'm like, you know what? I would maybe take that.
What's that like? That seems interesting. Did you see the Seattle Times had a story on the Marine layer?
On the with regards to the. There are. Wait, hold on. Teams with.
What are you looking for here?
Teams in the bottom. Basically, the like MLB. Never mind. I take this back. The run differential for teams who've scored a lot of runs is very good.
Okay.
For what it's worth. There is no team of the top, like, I don't know, just looking at it, like 20 teams in runs scored. Basically, all of them have positive run differential.
Wait, there's that many? So is it, it's like an NBA situation where everybody's above average? Because the worst teams are so bad?
16 of the top run scoring teams in the league all have positive run differential.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Mariners and the Tigers are the only teams with positive run differential who are not one of the top run scoring teams in the league. So
sense.
I think we can conclude confidently from this, scoring runs in baseball is good.
Exclusive must credit the podcast.
But like the D-backs are 15-20 and they've scored like the fifth most runs in the league and they're only +7. They have a worse run differential than the Mariners do, despite the fact that they've scored almost like up there with the most runs in the league. And you know what? I would maybe take that.
It'd be just fun to try on for a little while and see how it goes.
We lived it in the 90s also,
did.
Right?
This
and it was great.
Evening out for that.
I'm not going to lie. I loved it. Wait, so what did the Seattle Times have to say about run differential? Exclusive
about the Marine layer.
Some of these run differentials in baseball are kind of crazy this early in the season.
The Marine layer is real.
Okay.
Although FanGraphs apparently
did it conclude that it only applies to the Mariners, and then when it applies to the Mariners, only new signings of the Mariners.
They did suggest that perhaps there needs to be an adjustment of approach in response to the Marine. The Hardball Times research did suggest that maybe it's a mental element because, like, it's real, but it only accounts for like 7 feet on a fly ball at most.
I mean, 7 feet could be a pretty big deal.
I didn't go through and click through to the Hardball Times story, so I'm not sure like how they actually analyze that. But yes, it can be the difference between flying out of the warning track and a home run, certainly.
And did they didn't do anything in there that implied why it only applies to the Mariners and not to the visitors?
I don't think they did imply that because, again,
the Mariners have given up
allowed
the fewest runs
in the
league by like a pretty significant margin.
The park.
Wow, what we can conclude is this pitching rotation kind of sucks.
The park factors
overrated
are also real and suggest that T-Mobile Park is not good for scoring runs.
What if the new players are just kind of sad?
I think that might be part of it. They're just bummed.
They're bummed about not hitting homers, those 7 feet that they want back, but also just seasonal affective disorder. It's really real here.
I don't think if you're coming here April through October that seasonal affective disorder is an issue. They're exclusively here during daylight savings or would the opposite one, whichever
matter,
one it
though.
Is.
To me, we are in daylight time right now.
Okay.
Not standard time. We're not in standard time.
God, this joke again.
It's my favorite. It's actually the worst with regards to seasonal affective disorder in April because your body's like, let's go. It's spring. I'm ready for it. You travel around the country, things are looking nice, and then you come back to Seattle and you're like,
but then in July, you go other places and it's like 110 degrees in the shade and you come back here and you're like, huh, T-Mobile Park, not so bad. Marine layers ward off because it's warmer.
Wow. You sure have convinced me that Seattle is good for 1 month a year. No, I feel like...
Maybe two.
I mean, we'll see starting on Wednesday. This is I actually had this theory about children's baseball. I was like, the team lost because they're just all depressed. I can apply everything to seasonal affective disorder. I'm like, we should just prescribe this team.
So you're saying Seattle swoon is seasonal affective disorder?
Absolutely. It's called the Seattle swoon.
There it is. Wow, we've really put it all together there. Well, you know who emerged from the swoon?
If Dave Haxtell just prescribed some vitamin D, Matty Beniers would have been happy to have played for him. No ultimatums here.
That's restricted free agent Matty Beniers to you, sir.
Oh, Lord.
The Seattle Rain emerged from the swoon.
Our Rangers are 1-0 in the second round.
To score a pair of goals on Friday against the San Diego Wave in a pretty wild game. So they snapped their 5-game losing streak despite playing the vast majority of the game with just 10 players after Ziara King was sent off with a red card in the 9th minute for hitting Anna Lundqvist in the face. The San Diego Wave followed that up by taking the lead in the 11th minute shortly thereafter, but the shorthanded Rain tied the game through Bethany Balser in the 34th minute, got the winner from Veronica Lotzko in the 89th minute. 5 saves from Laurel Ivory, crucial to getting the 3 points that moved the Rain out of the NWSL cellar all the way up to 11th. That's out of 14 teams ahead of a 2-match week. They'll host undefeated Kansas City on Wednesday.
There is a Louisville team.
That is correct. But they're not as generically named.
They've no, that's why I know them.
Yeah. Before the season's first matchup with the Thorns in Portland on Saturday, since reassigning coach Mike Norris after earning just 1 point in their first 4 matches, the Thorns are 4-0 and now sit 4th. In the NWSL standings.
All right.
They escaped their swoon, too. Much, much more impressive fashion. Seattle Storm lost their preseason opener 84-79 to the LA Sparks in Edmonton on Saturday in front of a sellout crowd at Rogers Arena.
It's so funny. I asked you if this was a preseason game, and we talked ad nauseum about Edmonton.
We did. We did. That is correct.
It was gone. Gone after that. That's so funny.
Big story for the Storm, the return of Skylar Diggins-Smith to game action for the first time since 2022 after giving birth to her second child.
Hello.
Diggins-Smith had 14 points, 5 assists, 4 steals in 20 minutes. Looked very much like an all WNBA player. It was a rougher debut for Nneka Ogwumike, who shot 1 of 6 from the field against her former team.
Ah, I'd panic.
Yes. Storm hot takes. Storm played without Ezzie Magbegor, who was still working back in after arriving in camp late. Jordan Horston due to an ankle sprain, and rookie Nika Mule was unable to travel due to a passport issue. None of those players are listed on the Storm's availability report ahead of Tuesday's final preseason game hosting the Phoenix Mercury, so should be good to go. Storm will be without Jade Melbourne, who's in concussion protocol.
It's a violent sport, people.
UW softball, they swooned.
Oh, no.
Dropped both games Utah to conclude the regular season before Sunday's series finale was canceled due to weather. Both losses by 1 run.
They did not cancel Mateo's football game due to weather.
On Friday, Riley Holtorf's home run to lead off the 7th wasn't enough as UW lost 5-4. Saturday saw Utah scatter 8 hits while allowing just 1 run in a 2-1 victory. The 2 losses dropped the Huskies into a tie for 3rd with Oregon, and the Ducks held the head-to-head tiebreaker, meaning UW will be the number 4 seed in their final Pac-12 tournament starting Thursday in Palo Alto. Huskies will face Arizona, having taken 2 of 3 from the Wildcats in Tucson earlier this season. Latest softball poll hasn't been released, but you have to think that the Huskies, number 10 before these 2 losses, it's a must-win for them to have a chance of being one of the 16 regional hosts. And perhaps they might have to reach the final by also beating the winner of top seed UCLA in the play-in game. So,
okay.
Not great for UW softball after a strong start to the season.
I love that they're like number 15 in the country or whatever.
But the expectations are pretty high for you.
I know. Well, it's just, I mean, we talked about this. Not that many teams play softball, so.
True. The first transfers of the year for UW women's basketball is Tina Langley adds to her squad a pair of transfers, a pair of post players, Eastern Michigan center Tyra Eke and Yale forward Brennan McDonald. Eke, a native of Madrid, started her career at Long Island University before playing 2 years at Eastern Michigan, has 1 year of eligibility remaining. She averaged 9.5 points, 7.3 rebounds, 2.0 blocks last season. A bit prone to turnovers, 2.8 of those per game. McDonald emerged as a full-time starter in her third year playing at Yale, fourth year at the university, averaging 10.8 points, 6.9 rebounds, as well as 1.5 blocks. Shot a solid 55% on twos, has never made a three. She had to transfer to utilize her final season of eligibility because the Ivy League does not allow post-grad eligibility.
Wow. God, of course they don't.
Classic Ivy League move. Ugh.
I was going to say, there's a certain sect of the Pelton Cast listenership that would be really excited about a Yale transfer.
I think they would be, yes. I'm not blaming them for post-grad eligibility, I wrote about during the NCAA tournament, because USC had three starters who were transfers from the Ivy League around Juju Watkins on this year's team that reached the Elite Eight. Both those players bring much needed size to the front court, which featured just one rotation player, Delia Daniels, taller than 5'11" last season. Huskies also add 6'4" German freshman Annika Soltau, so can have a lot more size next year. UW men also adding more size in Oakland post Chris Conway, who started all 35 games at center last year for the team that upset Kentucky in the NCAA tournament, averaged 10.0 points per game, more than double his previous career high, as well as 4.1 rebounds per game. He's a fifth-year senior, 1 year of eligibility remaining, just 3 of 14 last season on threes. So unclear how he fits into the front court rotation, which already boasts centers Frank Kepnong, Wilhelm Breidenbach, and Casey Ebekwe.
Have we heard any news on Great Osabor?
We have not heard a decision yet.
Okay, not so great news.
We've just heard that he's not going to Kentucky.
I mean, that was great news.
Yes.
Not going to Kentucky. To me, I saw that and it was like, I mean, people, he's coming here.
But, I don't know.
But this particular addition makes me question that a little bit.
I mean, I think Osabor at this level is probably a power forward.
I mean,
I don't know if he was playing five at Utah State or not.
A lot of size.
Yeah. I mean,
is that a thing? I mean, you definitely never have too many shooters, but can you have too many big men?
If you try to play them all, if they all expect to play, you can. But, I mean, look, Frank Kepnong has had season-ending injuries the last 2 years. It's certainly a place you want cover, I would say. Osabor is listed as both Utah State's primary power forward and their primary center. No, because that's right, because in the NCAA tournament, they played Isaac Johnson.
What kind of crazy rules do they have over there?
They cloned Great Osabor? Danny Sprinkle, like, hey, this is great work. Isaac Johnson played a lot in the NCAA tournament game, the transfer from Oregon, and that kicked Osabor to the four. But he did start.
Where did Danny Johnson go?
Where did he train? I don't know if he transferred.
Still at Utah State?
Oh, Isaac Johnson started 29 to 33 games. So Osabor definitely did start at power forward, but also played a lot of center. He was their backup when was slid over when Johnson was on the bench. Does not appear that Isaac Johnson has transferred.
Bold.
All right, UW football. Dogs After Dark on Friday.
There
night.
We go.
The final, purple 24, white 23, with Grady Gross kicking a field goal on the final play with a crowd of his entire team around him, like really entirely too close, and the other team, which Grady Gross had just kicked a field goal for, going the other direction, yelling at him to miss this.
Had it all the way. You know I'm a big purple guy over white. This is a monster victory as we conclude spring football.
All right, so let's talk about the quarterbacks first. Will Rogers led four drives, which resulted in 10 points, through an interception in the end zone. Unclear if that might have been a miscommunication with his receiver. 14 of 25.
The communication was to not throw an interception. No.
14 of 25 for 154 yards, but I thought he was actually more impressive than those.
Did you watch this? Okay.
I did go back and rewatch this.
Okay.
Didn't watch it live since it was opposite the NBA playoffs. He pushed the ball downfield, which was to be my biggest concern.
Dinking and dunking.
Will Rogers.
This is like not very much time with Jed Fish.
No, and then his receivers, I think, let him down on a few of these plays. So I liked what I saw.
Okay.
And they split up the receiving core, like, basically. So, you know, each side, white and purple, had some of the starters for the most part. Damond Williams Jr. led five drives, which resulted in 11 points. He was 7 of 17 for 42 yards and threw a pick six to, why do I not have it? Thaddeus Dixon.
Okay.
So Williams, one of the interesting thing was he was like very quick to pull the ball down and scramble.
Okay.
Which works a lot better when you're playing tackle than it does when you're two-hand touch for the quarterbacks.
Yeah, no, it's one of those situations where if it was real football, he would have escaped some of the tackles.
Exactly. His accuracy was not there in the first half. We did see more of it in the second half. He threw a touchdown to Jeremiah Hunter and then followed it up with a two-point conversion to Hunter, and both of those were impressive.
Jeremiah Hunter's Colorado transfer?
Cal
transfer.
Yeah. And intriguingly, he's been running second string, it seems like, a lot of the spring.
Really? So. Who look like the starting wide receivers right now?
Well, Denzel Boston is, I mean, that was the number one takeaway from this, is Denzel Boston is that dude.
Denzel Beasting?
He caught a touchdown from Will Rogers, had a couple of deep passes, including one from walk-on QB Teddy Purcell, who both of his drives resulted in points. He had the highest points per drive of any of the UW quarterbacks. That was that was certainly interesting to see. A nice crowd, 19,000 is what they announced there.
We also got an Ephesians Pry Sock pick.
The Ephesians Pry Sock was the one who had the interception.
Hello!
He was primarily matching up with Denzel Boston. He's big.
Ephesians?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That was very exciting. So part of the scoring for this game was that various people were given an opportunity to kick field goals. Both soccer coaches were given an opportunity to.
That was part of the scoring?
Women's soccer coach
Nicole Van Dyke. Like it counted toward the point?
It did, yes.
Okay.
Hit a 25-yarder. Men's soccer coach Jamie Clark missed his. I forget who kicked for the offense, but.
Mayor Bruce Harrell.
Oh, I think it was Denzel Boston might have kicked for the offense.
Okay.
But for the defense, Carson Bruner kicked a 25-yard field goal.
And he banged it through?
Threw a, I believe it was a 43-yard completion on a trick play in this game. Carson Bruner was cooking in this one. Just having a great old time out there.
Oh, to Jonah Coleman also.
Yes, to Jonah Coleman. That was his biggest play of the day.
The receiving core is going to be fine. Just looking with Denzel.
Oh, I'm not that worried about it at all, no.
Yeah, Jeremiah Hunter, Denzel Boston, Giles Jackson. Like, I think this receiver, obviously, it's going to be a huge drop-off from where they were last year, having three day one, day two picks, but...
Yeah, that's the greatest UW receiving core of all time, excluding nobody.
They also had some pretty freaking good receiving cores not that long ago.
Not that good.
John Ross and Dante Pettis. John Ross was drafted higher than Roma Dunze was.
Yeah, how does NFL career go?
I'm trying to be fair to those teams.
But the difference is the third receiver. The fact that you had Jalen Polk in Jalen McMillan and Roma Dunze, like that depth is what, you know, they can't go. I don't know who the number three receiver was on that team, but there's no way they can compare, at least at that stage.
Chico McClatcher.
Freshman running back Adam Muhammad scored a touchdown in this one. I think had the only rushing touchdown and powered through a defender at the goal line. That was pretty impressive. Giles Jackson had a nice catch on a tip by Jordan Shaw, another transfer cornerback. Had a pretty bad drop later, but one of the biggest takeaway from this is, like, Jed Fish has talked about the emphasis on strength and conditioning and that element during the offseason workouts.
Yeah.
These dudes are small right now.
Really?
Like, noticeably bigger than last year.
Really? Do you feel like there's a little bit of, like, we're going to the Big Ten, we got to get some beef on these players?
I 100% think that is the case, yes.
Okay.
All right. The Huskies then...
We just have to play Iowa at some point, you know?
And they don't even have their number one offensive weapon anymore. Their punter.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the incoming transfers for the Huskies. With the conclusion of spring practice, we're seeing a number of players change teams, including multiple incoming recruits, transfers from Arizona. You'll never
shockingly.
Believe it.
Shockingly.
Running back Jordan Washington is one of those. He was committed to Fish as the highest ranked recruit in the 2024 class, enrolled
just
early.
Really a lot of running backs.
Yeah, I mean, it's a position where you want to have a lot of depth. We did not see any Cam Davis. Saw a surprising amount during the spring game of Danielle Nagata, who was basically only a factor on kickoff returns last season. It'll be interesting to see where he ends up. I mean, look, I don't know that Washington is going to play a lot, but it's interesting that he's coming here when Adam Muhammad, another Arizona commit as a true freshman, like, is going to be ahead of him, presumably, on the depth chart, just having been here for spring practice and played well and played a lot. Also, Arizona wide receiver Kevin Green Jr., a four-star recruit who spent 2 years at Arizona, recording 8 catches for 97 yards last season after recording no stats as a freshman when he preserved his red shirt. So he has 3 years of eligibility remaining. This one was exciting. Nevada tight end Kaleki Latu.
I love it.
The younger brother of former Husker Leatu Latu. Played 2 years at Cal, most recently one at Nevada. Was on his way to his best statistical season with 14 catches for 179 yards through 6 games before a season-ending injury. And a position where the Huskies don't have a lot of experience depth. So
yeah, no, I thought that was a great sign. It also shows me that Leatu Latu doesn't, if he'd had a bad experience at UW.
Right.
And obviously, kind of didn't end it great for Leatu Latu, but
I mean, that's UW's medical staff, like the doctors, yes. Not even the medical staff, you know, as opposed to the coaching staff. I don't think his issue was ever there.
But it does show me that we can now officially claim Leatu Latu
as
a Husky first round draft pick. There it is.
We can't claim him as a Seahawk, as we'll talk about later.
I mean, the draft already happened. I don't know.
I mean, yes, I'm aware.
I wasn't planning on it. I was drafted by another team.
But was not going to be drafted by the Seahawks, even had he not been drafted a pick ahead of them. Then Ohio State tackle Enoch Vimahi, but not Old Dominion tackle Chris Adams, who committed via social media, but now apparently headed to Memphis instead. Vimahi was a four-star prospect out of Hawaii in 2019, played... made his first career start for Ohio State in 2022 versus Michigan at left tackle. Then his second came in last year's Cotton Bowl at right guard. But after spring practice, determined, you know, I wanted to look elsewhere in search for more playing time as a sixth-year senior. So
a sixth-year senior.
Yeah, I mean, one of the notable features of that spring game was that the offensive line did not split up between the two teams. It was just the same offensive lineman the whole time. So there's still a lot of playing time to be earned at Husky offensive line. We'll see whether Vimahi ends up at tackle or at guard for UW. It would seem like left tackle is probably the single biggest need. Drew Azzopardi kind of locking down right tackle is one of the marquee transfers, someone who came in, committed to Kalen DeBoer, but stayed after
Jed Fish. If Enoch was a little bit younger, I'd be a little bit more excited about this. But.
For sure. And then Colorado long snapper Cameron Warchuk, who spent 3 years with the Buffaloes, becoming their exclusive long snapper last season, has 2 years of eligibility remaining. UW's former long snapper Jaden Green turned pro in March. So this was a position of considerable need for the Huskies. So we'll see if we have any more transfers coming. We'll probably still be a little bit of movement now that we've got spring practice in the books. But for the most part, starting to look ahead to the fall, and you know, we're about 3 months away from fall practice and leading up to this 2024 season, first in the Big Ten. It's going to be very interesting. All right, the Seahawks held rookie camp last weekend. Not a lot of huge surprises, I think, from that. You know, the offensive linemen sort of ended up. Well, I guess the one interesting thing, I guess, was the fact that their third-round pick out of UConn, Christian Haynes, was at right guard. So that would indicate that presumably he's going to compete with Anthony Bradford at that spot, and that Lincoln Tomlinson is penciled in as the starter at left guard, which is where they put at left guard their sixth-round pick, Toa Lamea from Utah, who they said was going to move inside after playing tackle at Utah. We did see DJ James working at nickel, which is sort of what we expected when they drafted both him and his Auburn teammate Nehemiah Pritchett on day three of the draft. Those are kind of the standout things. They renegotiated Mike Jackson's contract, giving them the necessary cap space to sign all their draft picks. Byron Murphy, the second's deal, already done, which is good news after Devin Witherspoon missed the start of training camp last year figuring out his contract.
Yeah.
And then an interesting piece from my ESPN colleague, Brady Henderson. He reported that the Seahawks' top draft targets were Murphy and J.C. Latham, who they planned to move to guard, as someone who was kind of reported as a tackle in the draft and was someone you were very intrigued by, I think, where he was going to go.
Kind of?
Which eventually was the top 10.
I mean, I I'm surprised that if they would have actually made this pick.
It certainly contradicts what we were thinking in terms of the value, you know, John Schneider, everything he said about the value of guards, if they were willing to take him and play him at guard. Although maybe part of the logic was, well, if something does happen to Abe Lucas, we've got the potential to kick him out to right tackle down the road.
I mean, I'm fine with that as a potential pick. I think ending up with Byron Murphy, both for roster construction, I think they ended up in the right place.
So Henderson reported they discussed trades down to 20th, 22nd, 23rd, 25th, with the Packers dropping out late in that process. And then 43rd, the Atlanta Falcons, which it's interesting to know what they would have been offering in terms of future for, you know, draft picks on top of that 43rd, since it's such a steep, you know, trade down from number 16.
For most of those, the additions probably wouldn't have been particularly significant.
Right.
So I don't know. I think this is fine.
It's certainly fine. I do think that one of the things that, like, everyone's saying, they got an elite prospect. Would you have said the same if they had drafted Johnny Newton at 16?
Probably not.
You don't think so? I mean, they were, like, some people had Newton rated ahead.
I don't think that people would have said that. I just think, where did he end up going anyway?
In the second round.
Yeah.
And that's part of my thought of, like, if they
Murphy
had moved
was
down
not to... going in the second round. I don't buy that Murphy would have stuck around until the second round.
I mean, maybe he wasn't, maybe he wasn't. But, like, if they would have drafted, traded down to 25th and drafted Newton.
When people say that they got an elite prospect, like, they still drafted a player at 16th in the draft. They got a player who his window for success is incredibly high. An elite prospect is a top five pick. Like, that is not, even Aaron Donald, when he was drafted a little bit later, like, there is a world that Aaron Donald wasn't a superstar NFL player.
Of course, there's this world where anyone isn't a superstar NFL player. I mean, I think...
It is Seahawks-colored glasses say that. They might have gotten the second-best defensive player in this draft, but to just carte blanche say that he's an elite prospect is not... That doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, I think you can make the case to, like, that a player can be an elite prospect and drafted outside the top five because people are overrating certain or underrating certain things.
Like Latu.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Aaron Donald's case, clearly his height was the fact that everyone overrated. Like, there was never any question about his production, and he did turn out to be an elite prospect. If you're going to make the case for Murphy, I think it's going to be based on, look, teams got obsessed with drafting offense, and they overdrafted all these offensive guys. And
quarterbacks. But yes.
Well, at wide receivers and tackles as well. And therefore, defensive players who were, like, relative to their position better and still at important positions got pushed down to the teens of this draft.
Sure. That might be the case. But just to be like carte blanche, he is an elite level prospect. Like, Byron Murphy was never in the top for the most part.
It's not like last year when, why am I blanking on your least favorite player?
Defensive Jalen Carter?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I actually, for what it's worth, I actually agree with that. Like, Jalen Carter was the top five pick all year. In every mock draft, all season, Jalen Carter was there. And then ended up going pick 10 and having a season where he didn't do a thing. He's like the Sounders playing on Sunday. That was actually Jalen Carter's season. 0-0 draw.
I don't believe anyone is awarding the Sounders any awards for this season.
PFF loved it. Loved everything about it. But no, that is a good example.
XG would be similar to the pass rush win rate in this particular case.
You leave and you'd be like, wow, what good XG. And they'd be like, look, he didn't make any plays, but that pass rush win rate, eh? Anybody?
But Sounders XG is still not leading the league, which would have to be the comparison here.
Among rookies.
Sure.
But there's a reality.
No one argued. Carter, they didn't give Jalen Carter defensive player of the year. They just gave him defensive.
I don't think he won defensive rookie of the year. But it was, what's his name, who won? It was the both Texans. Will Anderson won.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But Jalen Carter actually is a good example of Jalen Carter. You could reasonably argue, from an outside non-Seahawks perspective, was an elite-level player. Byron Murphy, I don't think you could actually argue. I mean, you can argue whatever the fuck you want. But, like, I don't think there's necessarily a reality to that. The Seahawks did, process-wise, draft a player who could. There's a world that Byron Murphy is the best defensive lineman in the NFL. That is not, it's not likely, but there's a world that is the case. It's not like they drafted an off-ball linebacker. And they also drafted a player at a position of need. So they still did. The process was overall mostly right.
Yeah.
And that's it. And if he might have been there at 20. He might have been there at 22. He might have been there at 23. They also might have drafted the same fucking guys that they drafted. Because once you get to a certain point of the draft, you're kind of just grabbing the players you want.
Oh, I think they probably would have. It's just you could have drafted a couple other guys.
You could have drafted a couple other guys beyond that. But like, is Christian Haynes on this team? Almost certainly yes. Is Tyrese Knight on this team? Also almost certainly yes.
And the other element is that you would just pay someone less if you draft them at 25 as opposed to 16 or wherever it is.
But it probably wouldn't be Byron Murphy. And there could be, if you're like Madden rating style, like window of, if Byron Murphy's like window of possibility is like 75 to like 94. And there's another, if it's Johnny Newton and it's like 70 to like 90, something like that. Like there's probably a better chance that Byron Murphy has an ability to be an elite level pass rusher or defensive lineman than Johnny Newton.
So. I mean, I think the fact that Newton dropped where he does, or went where he did, does indicate there's a certain gap between the two of those. But that's also kind of like, that's post hoc information. We don't know where Murphy would have gone if the Seahawks didn't draft him, because they did draft him.
I think that there's a good chance he would have been drafted around the same range. But again, we've talked about Justin Madubuike quite a bit, and he was a third round pick. And he was one of the better defensive linemen last year. So, I don't know.
The other interesting note from Brady that the Seahawks did not have Laiatu Latu or Troy Faiutanu in consideration for medical reasons. So they also preferred Murphy over Faiutanu from a scouting perspective. But that those guys were not, you know, if they were on the board at all, it was not in the first round. And it's just fascinating how different evaluations teams can come up with medically. And I do think, I don't know the NFL track record. In the NBA, these things have tended to be overrated.
Overrated? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think
Michael Porter Jr. went 13th. Denver Nuggets won a championship because the Clippers did not draft Michael Porter Jr. for medical reasons.
The Denver Nuggets won a championship because they drafted Jokic in the second round.
If they didn't have Michael Porter Jr., they would not have won a championship.
The NBA is not an appropriate comparison here, though.
I mean, certainly the physical toll of football is different.
But you're also talking about one of five players on the field, not one of 22 players on the field. Like, and you're to pick 13 in the NFL draft would have been like that player was drafted high, right? Whereas in the NBA, the talent drop off, the amount of players in the NBA who are contributing to an NBA team is 20 per year, something like that.
I mean, it depends on what you define as contributing, but yeah, it's a much smaller number.
So there's hundreds of players from this draft who are going to be playing next season and beyond. But to me, the difference is the investment that you have to make for somebody that you don't feel 100% confident going in their medicals. I think it makes sense to me that you shouldn't make a pick like that. If you're near apples to apples or slightly worse, but you feel better about somebody else's medicals, I would draft the other player. Even if there, again, if there is a, if Laiatu Latu is an elite level player for 10 games and then can't play beyond that or is constantly injured beyond that, who knows? Like, that is still not as good as having Byron Murphy at a very good level for 4 years.
Yeah, but just I don't think you can predict the odds of injury that well.
You can't predict the odds of injury that well, but it's about process-wise finding players who you can feel generally confident will contribute to your team, have a possibility of being very successful for 4 seasons, right? And be at a position of value. That's how you do the draft.
Yeah.
Paying Laiatu Latu to not play is a bad way to structure your cap. If that is a thing you think might happen.
But anything might happen. It's just, what are the realistic chances of that?
If you think there is even a slightly higher likelihood of it happening with Latu vis-a-vis Byron Murphy, I still think that's the right process.
Probably.
It's not viewing Laiatu Latu as a...
But other teams knew that Laiatu Latu... It's not like only the Seahawks were privy to this information.
We don't know that they're right. I mean, again, all it takes is one in a draft. It takes one team. Other teams probably would have drafted him.
But I think what I'm saying is I think Latu would have gone even higher if it absent the medical information.
Probably. He also might be an elite pass rusher for a handful of seasons, and he might get hurt at some point. We don't know.
Or he might play a totally normal career.
Yeah, that too. And then the Colts will have been... It's the Colts who drafted him, right?
That sounds right.
Okay, yeah, great. And then the Colts will have benefited from that, but they made a risk. You can't argue that they didn't take at least a slight risk on the pick.
I mean, probably.
Sometimes teams take risks and benefit from those risks.
Yeah. All right.
Is it the Colts?
It is the Colts, yes. Well, let's hope the Seahawks risk pay off, and let's hope the Le'Atu Latu one does too, because Husky legend.
This is nothing about Le'Atu Latu. I'm just saying, I think it makes sense for the Seahawks. I think the Seahawks did a fine job.
A fine job. On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.